Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, with unprecedented melting of the ice sheets and the worst drought in 55 years, we'll spend the hour exploring the problems and the solutions to climate change. The world is experiencing some of the most catastrophic weather conditions, floods, lethal heat waves, fires, and droughts. Climate scientists say these may occur with more regularity. With melting ice sheets, sea levels are rising and coasts are retreating. Some historians and political scientists warn that the resulting scarcities of resources, such as drinkable water and food, could lead to more violent conflicts. What are the possible solutions? We begin the hour with Joseph Rome. He is a senior fellow at American Progress, the editor of climateprogress.org, and the author of several books, including Hell and High Water, Global Warming, The Solution and the Politics. Welcome, Joseph Rome.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I think I'd like to start with the news that just came out on Greenland. As I understand, there's an unprecedented melting. What does this mean?
Well, you know, the planet is warming up because of carbon pollution. And one of the things that happens is the Arctic sea ice melts. But more worrisome is the land-based ice over Greenland. And NASA announced yesterday was that they saw an unprecedented surface melt. They actually saw 97% of the ice sheet thawing at some point in the last week or two. And, you know, they've had stunning warming. I did a blog post on Climate Progress that pointed out they saw in May 76.6 degrees Fahrenheit temperature. So it has been very warm in Greenland, and of course it's been warm here. And, you know, Greenland is seeing some accelerated melting.
And what happens when the ice sheets like this are melting to the rest of the planet?
Well, the main thing that would happen is the sea level rise, which has increased in the last few decades. And scientists say that is because of the melting of glaciers around the world. There is a massive amount of ice, I mean, over Greenland. I mean, it's like a mile thick over an area larger than Mexico. So it is huge. It's a lot of ice. And when that ice melts, ultimately, it can cause 20 feet of sea level rise. Now, the good news is it's not going to melt all this century, but the bad news is that the process is relatively irreversible after a certain point. So if we don't start cutting carbon pollution soon, then, you know, we may pass a point of no return on Greenland and leave our children and grandchildren with a ruined climate.
So the 97%, it sounds like on one hand they're saying 97%, and on the other hand you're saying, luckily, we aren't losing it all.
Yeah, well, let's be clear, and perhaps I was not crystal clear. So Greenland is a vast place, and when it melts, the whole thing doesn't melt. When they said 97% melt, they just meant the surface area, 97% of the surface area of Greenland saw melting sometime in mid-July. And that's just unprecedented. But, of course, it's a mile thick ice, so it doesn't, you know, it's not like it's all going to disappear very quickly. But it is worth noting, and this is why this matters, is that there is a feedback effect, a vicious circle or vicious cycle, as they say, when ice tends to be white, so it reflects sunlight. But when it melts into water, then it becomes more absorbent of sunlight, so it tends to heat up more. So basically what this means is that as when you start to melt, you tend to get more melting. Now, of course, some of it will refreeze because it gets really cold, you know, in Greenland, over large parts of Greenland, just by, let's say, September and October. So you get a melting and a refreezing, but the key thing that's been happening now is that in parts of Greenland that are nearer the coast, you get what are called moulins, which are these deep crevices where the meltwater can actually go to the bottom of the ice and actually grease it and cause some of the glaciers to speed out towards the sea. So there's a lot of dynamic processes that go on in Greenland, and, you know, if you talk to climate scientists, as I have, you'll find they're very worried that you could hit a point of no return where it's just very hard to stop. but we're not there yet.
I'm going to want to go back to that issue of point of no return, and specifically with James Hansen's question about a tipping point. Before we do that, I'd like to talk about a few of the other things we're seeing now to see how these all fit together. One is something that you have written about. Last year, you wrote in a publication called Nature. You coined the phrase dust bowlification, which you said you use this phrase instead of desertification because of the biodiversity issue. What is happening in terms of these droughts? We've had enormous droughts. And why the new phrase instead of the old one?
Well, people have often used the phrase desertification to mean the spread of deserts. And I did that for a while until some people on my blog, Climate Progress, said, well, you know, many deserts, if you've been to the Southwest, have a lot of life. You know, there's a lot, that's what we mean by biodiversity. There's a lot of life, a lot of animals. You've got cactus, you've got other plants. And that's different than, say, what happened during the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, where you had the heat and the drought, and you just turned farmland into, you'd ruin the topsoil, and you just had dust, and you didn't have much living. Then you had a desert that looked more like, let's say, people's idea of the Sahara Desert, if you see what I'm saying. The difference, what gets called a desert can be anywhere from what we envision as the Sahara to, you know, if you've been to the desert Southwest, it's called a desert, but it's got a lot of plant and animal life and all that sort of thing. So here's what's going on. You warm up the planet when you put in the heat-trapping carbon pollution. Warming the planet means that semi-arid places, dry areas, dry up more because the hotter it gets, the more you evaporate moisture. Now, when you got rid of all the moisture in the soil, then all of the sun's heat now goes into heating up the ground. So you get these record heat waves. And the reason the United States is seeing record heat, so much record heat, I mean 40,000 temperature records have been set this year alone. The reason we're seeing this record heat is because more than half the country is in drought, and about 80% of the country is abnormally dry. And like I said, when you have widespread drought, you set heat records, and that's why many heat records in the U.S. were set during the Dust Bowl, and now we're topping the Dust Bowl temperatures.
And it's been said that it's been 55 years since we've seen a drought like this. Some people would argue, of course, that maybe it is cyclical, but given all of the other symptoms we're seeing, it doesn't seem like that at all.
Well, I think people should know that there are cycles in nature. Most of them have to do either with changes in the Earth's orbit, and those occur over tens of thousands of years. And then there are much smaller cycles that have to do with things like El Nino and La Nina, which has to do with the temperature in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. But what we're doing now is we are goosing or juicing up the natural cycles, and the analogy, the metaphor people use is it's like a baseball player on steroids, the climate on carbon pollution, because like a baseball player who's on steroids, if they hit a home run, you can't be certain that, you can't say necessarily the home run was caused by the steroids, but the steroids made the home run go further. And then if that player gets 70 home runs and, you know, blows away the all-time record for home runs in a season, then you say that was caused by steroids. So what we're seeing now is the warming planet is, the global warming is clearly making the droughts and heat waves worse, and it's increasing their frequency and their probability. So that's what's going on, and that's just going to get worse and worse. Now, eventually, the climate just changes. That is, instead of just having longer and longer droughts, eventually what happens is the actual climate of the Southwest turns from being semi-arid to just being arid. And then it's also, you know, up by the end of the century, it could be 10 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, and I can assure you all the people who have been moving to the Southwest are going to leave, you know, not all of them, but a large faction of them are going to leave. Again, unless we act within to sharply reduce carbon pollution using energy efficiency, wind power, solar, and the like. And I worked for the Department of Energy for 5 years in the 1990s, and I ran the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. So I've written many books explaining that we have technologies that can replace fossil fuels now, and we don't have to go to zero tomorrow. We have time to make a transition, but we are losing time because we were warned to take action by climate scientists Decades ago, climate scientists predicted that this carbon pollution was going to cause worse heat waves, worse droughts, worse wildfires, which we're seeing, and also in wet areas would get wetter because the heat warms up the oceans. The oceans put more water vapor into the atmosphere, and that gets sucked into big storms and dumped on land. So wet areas get wetter, dry areas get drier, areas prone to wildfires get more intense wildfires.
Now, you said we could potentially reverse this, or at least slow it down. Both Bill McKibben and James Hansen, well, Bill McKibben uses James Hansen's numbers, but McKibben wrote a piece in Rolling Stone this week about understanding the key numbers, one of which is the 350 parts per million. What are all the key numbers, and what do we need to know about them?
Well, you know, I think I would urge people to go to the Rolling Stone piece, and they can certainly come to Climate Progress, because I have, you know, McKibben's piece is posted online, or link, you know, excerpts from it, and then a link to it. So his piece is titled "Global Warming's Terrifying New Math," and it's still on the front page of Climate Progress. I would say here's what people need to know: concentrations in the air of carbon dioxide were about pre-industrial, before we started burning coal, oil, and natural gas, was about 280 parts per million. And we're very close now to 400 parts per million. And scientists, and so we're going up about 2 parts per million a year. And basically what McKibben says is that we are getting close. We've warmed, a little more than a degree Fahrenheit, and if we, maybe almost a degree and a quarter. And we've got more warming built in because the climate of the Earth hasn't even sort of equilibrated to the carbon pollution that we've put in it. So his article is about how much more carbon pollution we can afford to put in before we start risking, you know, these permanent dust bowls and ever-rising sea levels and unbearable temperatures. And the answer is, you know, if we don't start cutting carbon pollution soon, we are going to just increase the risks of those to a point where eventually they'll just become near certainty. And his last point was, you know, some people are celebrating all of this oil and unconventional oil and unconventional natural gas that we're finding, you know, the fracking, the shale gas, and people are fracking to get oil too. And, you know, in the short term, it provides some economic wealth, there's no question. But we have 5 times as much carbon in all of the proven reserves than of fossil fuels than the planet can tolerate without getting to the point where we're going to spin out of control. So his bottom line is we're not going to be able to burn all of those fossil fuels, not if we, you know, care about our children and our grandchildren and don't want to leave them a ruined planet.
And this is what Hansen called the tipping point.
Yeah, and I'll be frank, no one knows exactly what point is the tipping point. It's not like if you were overweight, no one can say, well, if you're 50 pounds overweight, you're okay, but if you're 70 pounds overweight, you're going to get diabetes. I mean, we don't have that kind of knowledge. All people can say is, as you get more and more overweight, or if you want to use the smoking analogy, as you smoke more and more cigarettes, your chances, you're going to experience more and more symptoms, and eventually you're going to hit a level of toxicity that does damage that will prove, you know, truly fatal or catastrophic. So, we have a very good idea on the path that we're on, we are definitely, you know, I say with very high certainty, headed to some very bad outcomes. But again, I wouldn't be writing my blog, Climate Progress. I wouldn't be talking to you if I didn't know, you know, with equally high certainty that if we got our act together, if we could start, you know, aggressively reducing carbon pollution, we could definitely avert the worst consequences.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are speaking with Joseph Rome. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the editor of climateprogress.org. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are speaking with Joseph Rome. You're in the Department of Energy, so you actually worked on these policies.
Yep.
Did you have a sense that you could move them forward, or did you feel like you were getting thwarted for political reasons or economic reasons or just plain old we can't do this reasons?
Yeah, well, I worked at the U.S. Department of Energy for 5 years in positions that where I helped oversee $1 billion of investment in clean energy with major U.S. companies. And we partnered with car companies to develop advanced batteries and hybrid technology. And, you know, we partnered with solar companies to develop better solar technology. And you know, so across the board, clean energy, energy efficiency. There's no question that many of these technologies which we invested in are now commercial, and in fact, many of the wind and solar companies, wind and solar power are among the fastest growing forms of energy in the world. So, yes, the technologies exist and they've been coming down in cost, but, you know, there are barriers, and of course, there's the political opposition. It is certainly the case that for various reasons, the conservative movement in this country has decided that it is going to be anti-scientific and deny basic science and fight efforts to replace dirty fossil fuels with, you know, the clean renewable energy that never runs out.
Well, given that that force controls the House of Representatives, are we seeing a complete stall in terms of things advancing for the sake of renewable energies and reducing emissions in the Congress?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of tragic. But even a simple thing like the wind production tax credit, which provides, you know, a little more than 2 cents per kilowatt hour subsidy to wind turbines, which has been really critical in sustaining the wind industry and increasing the domestic content of wind so that before, you know, like 5, 6, 7 years ago, before President Obama was elected, sometimes as little as a quarter of the content of a wind farm in this country was made in the U.S., but now it's well over 50%, and it's headed towards 70%. But, you know, if you keep flipping the incentive, the investment, on and off, then companies eventually look for other places. And the Chinese have publicly announced a goal of having a level of wind power which is just staggering, far beyond ours, and by 2020, and so they are naturally developing a very, very dominant wind industry.
One of the items on your Climate Progress blog was about using public lands for solar projects.
Yep.
What is this project, and how far has it come so far?
Well, you know, the public lands were you know, set aside over the course of many presidencies, you know, the most famous being Republican Theodore Roosevelt, and he just felt that, you know, these large tracts of land that needed to be preserved in the public interest. Now we see that many of them are in the desert Southwest, where it is sunny most of the time, and, you know, solar farms can generate vast amounts of renewables, and other parts of the public lands can generate large amounts of wind power, and then others can develop geothermal. So the Department of Interior and the Department of Energy, you know, are working together to develop a plan to speed up the process for getting solar projects on public lands. And I have a blog, I have a post on the blog by our public lands team that talks about this new model for solar development.
The states are also somewhat active. California's been very active, of course. What was surprising was that states like New Jersey, headed by a conservative governor, Chris Christie, was being very aggressive with renewable energy. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, although we've been... many countries in Europe, most of the European countries, have what's called a renewable electricity standard, where every utility has to have a certain fraction of their energy come from renewable power. Over half the U.S. states do, and many of them have strengthened them. And we have a post on Climate Progress which talks about how New Jersey Governor Chris Christie recently signed into law a stronger renewable electricity standard, and that's simply because the first renewable standard that they had was generating lots of jobs, and industry was coming, and it's high tech, and it's manufacturing, and it's these are good paying jobs, and obviously there's something any state would want, and it's well known in economics that if you have a large demand for some product in a state or in a country, that industry is going to develop locally to deliver that good to that product. It just makes sense because it's just so much cheaper and easier and faster. So there are states that are competing to be, you know, the green Silicon Valley, and obviously California is where, which has the real Silicon Valley, you know, has been leading the way, but other states see the jobs benefits, and we have certainly created a lot of clean energy jobs in recent years.
Do you see that as really threatened now if the presidency were to change?
I think based on the statements that have been made publicly by Mitt Romney, there's no question, and equally important, by the Republican leadership that Obama, you know, has been fending off, in the Republican leadership in Congress, that indeed, if we had a wholesale switch in governing this country, then one would expect that renewable energy would have a hard time. And, you know, it's kind of really tragic because, like I said, many other countries are really boosting up investment. Even in these tough times, China is putting a lot of money into it. And the United States invented the modern solar cell in Bell Laboratory over a half century ago, and it is... It'd be shame if we lost entirely, you know, world. We don't have world leadership anymore. China does, but we do have a thriving industry, and it would be a shame if we lost our entire solar industry to China. When again, it was basically an American product at one point, and clearly, by the way, and I think this gets back to the global warming issue. I can tell you with certainty, we are going to replace the entire energy system of the planet with clean energy, with you know, the carbon-free energy over the course of this century. We are going to have to do that. The only question is whether we do it fast enough to avoid the worst of global warming, but we're going to have to do it because if global warming will just keep getting worse and worse, and at some point people will realize, heck, we can't have, you know, 10-degree Fahrenheit warming, or we can't have 15-degree Fahrenheit warming. So we are going to make this move, and that means the countries that lead the way on clean energy and develop the competitive advantage, they're going to generate all the jobs. They're going to generate literally millions of jobs in the coming decades. And, you know, China figured it out, and Japan figured that out, and South Korea figured it out, and Germany and much of Europe has figured it out. And we used to know this, but then, you know, again, the conservatives in Congress have just slashed and fought bitterly any efforts to increase clean energy.
There's a discussion going on about whether or not people's personal lives have an impact collectively. Some people say not really. Other people say collectively, absolutely. Do you have a sense of what people individually can do, should do, or whether or not they have no impact at all?
Well, I mean, it's similar in my mind, and it's a very good question, but I think it's similar to voting. I mean, you know, in general, your one vote does not decide elections. I mean, occasionally it does, but I don't think anybody would. I mean, and there are obviously people who feel, well, I'm not going to vote because my one vote doesn't matter. But I don't think that's a good argument for not voting at all. And I think every individual needs to do what they feel comfortable doing. I might first and foremost recommend that people become knowledgeable in this subject, because hopefully, when they become knowledgeable, they read climateprogress.org, and there are other great websites, they will become motivated to reduce their own pollution, which in many instances will save them money. I mean, many of the local utilities will help them do an energy audit, and they can cut their energy costs. They can buy Energy Star products. Green energy is now, in some places, about the same price as regular energy. So I don't view reducing your carbon pollution as something that I view that as a good thing all by itself, separate from global warming. But, you know, I do think that realistically, if people want to, you know, have a big impact, if they want to have a big impact, they need to get politically active. But in any case, if it so happens that the U.S. and the world is irrational, you know, and self-destructive and lets all this happen, you still need to know about global warming, because you're going to have to make decisions that affect your family. Do I own coastal property? Am I going to retire in the Southwest or in Florida? You know, where should I live? What should my kids study in school in a world that's going to be so completely different? What's the right skill set to have? So I tell people, you know, not learning about global warming isn't going to make, I mean, it might make you feel better in the short term, but since it's, you know, change is going to happen. Either we're going to change the energy system, or we're going to change, or the climate system is going to change. Either one of those things people need to know about, because it's going to affect them and their kids. And if they're smart, they can be proactive, be part of the solution, but they can also plan and make smarter decisions than, frankly, people who aren't informed.
And finally, you kept mentioning China as becoming a leader in renewable energies, whereas a lot of people are studying China as really a leader, an up-and-coming leader in pollution. How do you see China's role in the future in the balance of these two things?
Sure. Well, you know, China is schizophrenic on this, much as the United States is, but maybe even more. China may be the most schizophrenic country in the world on climate, because on the one hand, we talked about their aggressive renewable goals and their leadership. They've, in 10 years, they've gone from virtually no solar industry to a major solar industry. They're doing the same thing in wind. But then on the other hand, as you point out, they passed us and now have, they've been building coal plants at the rate of one or two a week for a decade now, and it's really stunning. And as a result, they now burn three times as much coal as the United States does, and they have total emissions that are like 30 to 40% higher than ours. So, yeah, that is their, it's the Dickens said in Tale of Two Cities. It's the best of times and worst of times, China. And China, you know, and of course, you can't burn that much coal without causing massive air pollution problems. And Americans occasionally get the news stories from China about how bad the air pollution is in Beijing and how many people are suffering. And so China is schizophrenic on it. It has some people who in the government who understand and who are focused on the right thing, but, you know, it also has powerful fossil fuel industries and energy industries, just like the United States, who wield a lot of influence and power.
Well, that's a place that we should end. Joseph Rome is with us. He's the senior fellow at American Progress. He's editor of climateprogress.org, and he's author of several books, including Hell and High Water, Global Warming, The Solution and the Politics. Thank you so much, Joseph Rome.
Sure, my pleasure.
When we come back, solutions to the sustainability crisis. Stay tuned.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings streaming down from the higher seas, deflected by the ground. They crown the sun, they crown the sun,
they crown the sun,
they crown the sun,
they crown the sun.
But I believe that they are free when their time was done.
Their time was done.
Hello, and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armodian. Given the unprecedented melting of the Greenland ice sheets and the extensive droughts, fires, and other extreme weather conditions, we've assembled three scholars to discuss solutions to the climate change problem. Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program. He develops computer models to study the effects of energy technologies and their emissions on climate and air pollution. William Mumma is with us. He is professor of international environmental policy and director of Fletcher's Center for International Environment and Resource Policy at Tufts University. He is a lead author of five intergovernmental panels on climate change reports, most recently coordinating lead author of the newest report on the role of renewable energy in addressing climate change. Ravi Rajan is professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he is the author of Modernizing Nature, Forestry in Imperial Eco-Development, 1800 to 1950. Ravi Rajan, let's have you start and walk us through your work in terms of sustainability issues and how they have affected human rights, poverty, these kinds of socio-political issues.
Sustainability traditionally has often been talked about in respect to the relationship between us as humanity and the rest of nature. And we have done, there's been a pretty fairly long and concerted discussion about the concept of sustainability. One can argue going back at least to the 18th century when systems and regimes of resource management like forestry and irrigation and so on were first established, and I've written quite a bit about that. Obviously, in the modern sense, sustainability refers to the relationship between biocapacity of the planet, if you will, and our ability to mobilize resources to live within our biological or biotic means, if you will. But there's another dimension to this sustainability debate, which has to do with human rights. And that has to do with the fact that in the course of development over the past 300 years or so, three particular things have happened. One of them is that been inequity in the way in which the mobilization of resources has benefited people that it is meant to benefit. So the first problem is what I call the problem of sustenance, or in other words, the problem of the absence of good or sustaining environments, or in other words, for various reasons, someone or the other, some group, country, entity has grabbed some of the most productive resource frontiers, be they forests, be they water, be they productive agricultural lands, etc. The second is the presence of bad environments, pollution being one, the presence of disasters, extremely toxic environments to live and work in, etc. This is the problem of what I call security. And lastly, I think there is what I call the problem of suffrage. Suffrage has often been considered to be about the ability to vote. But in reality, it's, as far as I'm concerned, for millions upon millions of people in the world, suffrage is really about having a say in the quality of the environment they live in. And virtually no political environment, one can argue, in the world fundamentally addresses environmental suffrage in this particular way. So if you ask me what sustainability's broader problem is, while I would concur that it has to do, certainly the starting point has to do with humanity and its relationship with the rest of nature, I would simultaneously say that it is equally about sustenance, security, and suffrage.
Ravi Rajan, many scholars are finding that climate change is thought to be exacerbating these issues and even exacerbating the greater security issues, such as physical violence that it may provoke.
Yeah, this is, I think, I would argue, an absolute verity. There is this point for all the attempts to manufacturing dissent in this context. I think pretty much all of us in the scientific community are agreed that climate change does represent arguably one of the greatest threats that humanity at large has set. Of course, we've all read about the big macro trends about the state of the planet in relation to climate change. But I think where the rubber meets the road, the real conflicts are already beginning to occur. And they concern primarily, effectively, minor changes in climate change that affect things like river courses, the ebbs and flows of rainfall, the retreatment of vegetation, and so forth. And what this really does is it directly impacts on the economic viability of millions of people. And one of the biggest challenges, of course, even whilst I think we try and grapple with the sorts of responses that we as a planet need to make and try and get corral nation states and companies into treaties that are binding, is also to understand how we adapt at the micro level to these changes. It's something that's, I think, relatively less talked about, although in the scientific community, it is very much a significant question. How do we adapt to what is clearly a set of trends that affect the viability and livelihoods of people?
Well, that's a perfect place to bring William Mumah in. Please, William Mumah, respond to this. And also this point that Ravi Rajan is making about securing global agreements with regards to sustainability and climate change.
The points that Ravi has made are very pertinent. And the thing to remember is that the purpose of development is to improve the well-being of people. And unfortunately, we tended to focus mostly on only one component of what is known as sustainable development, which is the economic component. And in doing so, we've chosen ways of development which actually are degrading the environment, including the dramatic changes that we're seeing to the climate system. And the other component is the social development component, which Ravi works very much in. And that has been largely ignored in the last 20 years since sustainable development was agreed to as the framework that governments would use. And governments had a very hard time addressing climate change in particular, because if you think about it, it's all about telling people what they cannot do. And when you listen to the diplomats, they talk about burden sharing. Anything that they're going to do is burden sharing. As I've said in a recent paper, imagine a diplomat coming home and telling your fellow countrymen that the burden that you've brought them to share, because it's all viewed as things that we have to stop doing. And indeed, we do have to stop putting these gases in the atmosphere and releasing black carbon. But there is nothing in any national interest other than saving the climate, which doesn't seem to be in any national interest, unfortunately, of addressing the pollution side. It's a pollution control attempt treaty that we've been attempting to negotiate. And what we really need is a sustainable development treaty. And some things are moving in this direction. Some of the work that Mark Jacobson has done showing the possibilities of renewable energy and low-carbon energy in particular have led to programs, the Energy for All program, which unfortunately is voluntary and put in terms of things we ought to do. But only if we move in those directions are we going to get something that's in the interest of all the parties, so that we can begin to really address climate change from a sustainable development perspective rather than a pollution control perspective.
I'm going to want to go back to that a bit, but since you have cued Mark Jacobson, it's the perfect time to bring him in. Mark Jacobson, great to have you back with us again. You and your co-authors have been studying how to take the entire planet to renewable energy, and you've argued that it's completely feasible to do this through wind, mostly, and solar water. So let's start with an overview in this.
Sure. Well, first, we think it's technically feasible to repower the world. And when I say technically, in terms of the resources, in terms of materials, in terms of even costs, whether it happens or not will depend a lot on politics and whether people really want to do it and try to change the subsidy system. But in terms of looking at the big picture, right now, if we look at the end use power demand worldwide, it's about 12.5 terawatts. That number might not mean anything, but just as a relative number, let's say 12.5 terawatts. In 2030, with business as usual, if population goes up and we keep using more energy, it's estimated to be about 17 terawatts. It turns out if we convert the entire energy infrastructure for all purposes, that's electricity, for heating and cooling, for transportation, and for industrial processes, if we convert it to electricity and electricity-derived hydrogen, so convert all, for example, combustion vehicles to electric vehicles or some hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. If we convert any combustion process to an electric process, we go down, the total power demand goes down by about 32% worldwide to 11.5 terawatts. In fact, in the United States, it would go down by 37% just because of the efficiency of electricity. So we looked at, to get that 11.5 terawatts, what do you need and what kind of resources do you need? And so we figured that we could do it with about 50% wind, 40% solar, and 10% all the other clean renewables. And we looked at how many devices you would need and how much land you would need for this. And these are not large numbers when you consider this magnitude of what we're trying to do. For example, it's about 4 million 5-megawatt wind turbines to do 50% of the world. And in World War II, the world produced about 800,000 airplanes in 4 or 5 years. So 4 million wind turbines, it's not really out of our reach. But to get that, to actually do that, it takes a lot of political willpower. And there's so many competing interests in the natural gas, because the natural gas prices are low now, and also still with coal in many countries, and oil is not going away very quickly. So I think that's the big challenge, is how to convince people to, even if they're the same price, say wind, and which is, I mean, wind is the second largest new source of electric power in the U.S. on average for the last 5 years. And this last year, wind plus solar were 68% of all of Europe's new electric power. But there's still a lot of new natural gas and coal going in. And so how do you get the wind and solar more preference than these other technologies to really change the entire energy infrastructure? And that's the big challenge.
Ravi Rajan, let's bring you back in for a moment. One of the issues that I think might come up with regards to the renewable project, if we were to go forward with Mark Jacobson's ideas and research, one of the issues is reducing pollution, of course. But on the other hand, there's also the materials issue. Can you speak to this in terms of social and political justice and how that is affected?
Everything, every public policy or allocation question has costs and benefits. And I think overall, the big question that one's going to ask is trade-off between persisting with this high fossil fuel intensive pathway as opposed to alternatives. So to imagine that there's going to be no conflict nowhere is fantasy land. One would imagine, and I haven't actually crunched all the numbers because this isn't exactly my particular field, but one would imagine very clearly that the benefits of what is being proposed here in terms of transitioning to a renewable energy economy can be spectacularly good. There are large swaths of the planet that have absolutely no access to fossil fuels. And one can imagine that there is a brewing volcano, mix these metaphors up, in the sort of largely expanding portions of Asia in particular, with the large economies there trying to line up the existing fossil fuel resources. Clearly, if it is possible to use, harness renewable sources of energy a lot in the scale that's being proposed here, I cannot see anything but a win-win, to be brutally honest. And because energy is crucial, and we've got to find some way of harnessing it.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about potential solutions for the climate change crisis. William Uma, let's bring you in here. We've all just concluded Rio, the conference there. Was something like this taken up in any meaningful way?
Well, I think most people who have followed this at all are quite disappointed in what governments did at Rio. I knew there was something to be concerned about when the headliner on the official Rio summit was extolling 700 voluntary agreements. That was an indication that maybe we didn't have any other kind of agreements to talk about. There's nothing wrong with voluntary agreements, except that, you know, you're never sure whether they're going to get put in place or not. But there's actually was far more action outside of what governments were doing than there was inside what governments were doing. And that's where it has to be done in any case. But without overall policy directions, it's very, very difficult to get everybody moving in the same direction, get everybody on the same page, so to speak. It's not just that the fossil fuels are, well, we usually talk about how coal is so cheap, but coal is not cheap because basically we're paying huge costs for the use of coal. Economies, particularly in developing countries, are just having their economies devastated by having to pay for oil with hard currency, and the price of that keeps fluctuating upward and downward and very high, and is devastating these economies. And none of that is taken into account when we say that these fuels are cheap. On top of this, the industries themselves have been making a mighty effort to sow a lot of disinformation about climate change, making it very difficult to get any kind of a political agreement. And finally, one of the wonderful things about the proposal that Mark and his co-workers have made and others have made similar sorts of things is that, you know, renewable energies are, solar and wind, for example, are brought to you for free. And the scale of them is huge. There's 8,000 times as much solar energy hitting the earth as we use in commercial energy every year. There's perhaps 12 times as much wind energy that can be harnessed on the earth compared to what we use. And every place in the world has access to some flow, some natural energy flow that can fuel their economies. And that would greatly reduce conflict and go a long way towards alleviating poverty in the world. And yet, government after government is defending the status quo, as one diplomat said, long after the quo has lost its status. So it's troubling, and it's a challenge for us. And we need to figure out how to make this be seen as opportunities rather than as a problem.
William Mumo, you've written about the limitations of international law, and partly because of how it privileges economic interests. Can you talk about this system as you've seen it and how it is hindering our forward motion?
Yes. What has happened, and this happens periodically, and it's to greater or lesser extent, that economic interests tend to dominate policy decisions. And when you have extremely large economic interests, like some of the energy companies now, like the banks now, they're able to dictate policies which basically support them rather than address the problems of society. And so it's interesting. If you look at the United States, we have very little policy at the top. That is, there's very little national policy. And yet, at the state level, if you look at what California is doing with its implementation of AB 32, which would basically reduce carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, this is far ahead of what any government in the world is doing. I just happened to see something the other day when I put solar panels on my house in 2006. There were so few being installed at that time in Massachusetts, but there's over something like 30 times that number being installed in 2012. That's a relatively short time to see that kind of an increase. So there's action at the local level. There's action at the city level, at the regional level, at the provincial and state level, because you do not have to balance at that level. I mean, there is no oil industry in Massachusetts. There is no coal industry in Massachusetts. So we can set policies that don't simply reinforce coal and oil. And there is still a role for international agreements. The fact that we have a climate treaty has brought to the attention of the world that all the governments agree this is a problem. And interestingly enough, even when the United States pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol, this unleashed a huge amount of mayors for climate change in the United States. And these are in politically red states and blue states. It's quite amazing. There are over 1,000 cities that mayors have made commitments to do something about climate change. So we need these treaties as kind of a statement that this is the direction we need to go, but we can't see them as the instruments for solving the problem. That's got to be done nationally, subnationally, locally, outside of government, private sector, NGOs, universities, the press, the media, everything.
Several directions we can go with that last bit that you said, but first let's go back to Mark Jacobson and talk about cost. You've done kind of an overview of how much it would cost. I'd like you to break that down a little bit in comparison to other energy uses that we have now, or energy sources. But then I wonder, because William just talked about industry, for example, if it might be possible to break out the costs for some of these big energy companies to move long-term into these renewable energies, and if that might be a motivational factor.
Yes. Well, let me start by touching on a point that you made earlier, which was renewable energies like solar and wind, they're very capital intensive, but they have zero fuel costs. So there's an upfront cost that's somewhat higher than traditional fuels, but they have zero fuel costs. So when you look at the what's called the amortized cost, or the cost for the electricity cost per kilowatt hour generated, for wind and hydroelectric and geothermal, they're very similar costs right now, when I say wind, onshore wind, to traditional coal and gas, although gas prices have dropped in the last couple of years. So So those are very competitive. But the point that the reason that's important that there's no fuel cost for these renewables is that fossil fuels, their price fluctuates. And so you're subject to this price volatility and booms and busts and economic upturns and downturns. And these can be severe, especially as you go on and the fossil fuels become more scarce, the prices are only going to rise. Whereas for infinity time, effectively, for infinite time, renewable energies like wind and solar in particular, they'll have no fuel cost at all. And so you can have more price stability and social stability and economic stability in the long run with these technologies. But in terms of the kind of costs, these costs per unit energy generated, solar has been traditionally more expensive than the others, but the price has dropped significantly in the last few years. And so you see this massive growth, as was previously mentioned, in solar. And so that's becoming more competitive. Then there are different types of solar. There's solar thermal, which is hot water heating on your roof. There's photovoltaics for electric power. There's what's called concentrated solar power, where you focus light from the sun onto mirrors that go to a central tower receiver and heat a fluid, and that eventually runs a turbine. But the nice thing about that is you can actually store electricity at night, and so you have storage in concentrated solar. In fact, there's a plant in Spain that produces electric power from the solar for 24 hours straight, and that allows you to manage the grid a lot easier and match the supply with demand, which is the traditional complaint about wind and solar, that they're too variable, that you can't control the wind and the sun, and as a result, you can't match the power demand with the supply. But you can with these storage devices. So the costs of some technologies are already competitive. Others are coming down. We don't think this is an issue. But the one more point I want to make about this is that these externality costs or health costs that have also been mentioned today, I mean, these are significant. We just did an analysis for New York State and found that the mortality due to air pollution in the state, which is around 4,000 deaths per year, and in the U.S. it's about 50 to 100,000. Worldwide, there are about 2.5 to 3 million people die a year from air pollution. But in New York State alone, that mortality plus the morbidity associated with it, it costs the state about 3% of its gross domestic product. And in fact, we calculated that with that cost, you can actually pay for an entire clean renewable energy infrastructure just from the cost savings alone from the mortality morbidity cost in about 17 years. And this is an amazing statistic, how significant, how large these costs are that are being sent to the taxpayers and to the insurance rate payers. I mean, our insurance costs are higher because of these health costs. Our taxes are higher because of them. And so not only we're subsidizing these industries in two ways, not only do they get direct subsidies, but they don't have to pay for their health costs they're incurring to society. So instead of a free market economy, it's more like a freeloading market economy in the case of these subsidies.
Well, I think there's one last point that I'd like to get to, which both of you are illuminating in different ways. Mark Jacobson, by all this amazing information. William Mumma, also, you mentioned the media directly. This is an area that Ravi Rajan also studies. Ravi Rajan, you have found that media actually confuses these issues. How would you say media is falling down on the job, and how could it or they actually serve society better with this matter?
Yeah, well, this is something that has been studied quite a bit. For example, my colleague Max Boykoff recently published a book exactly on this at Colorado. And the fundamental, there are many issues to it, of course, one of which is the fact that the media is not really a monolithic entity. It's got in it people, groups, and interests that are funded to produce or push one or another argument. There are also some internal constraints, such as the need to frame issues in binary oppositions, to create controversies of multiple perspectives, even when there might not be any, and so forth. Clearly, what we do have with media, of course, is a consolidation of power in the hands of a very few media outlets. But I think these are things that we do know. But I think one of the, I'd like to sort of look at this positively as well, in the fact that we now do have the means to, at least technologically, create a context or an environment in which perhaps better communication could be pushed out. So that, as far as I see it, one of the challenges that we have as an academic or a scientific community is in some respects to harness the emerging of web-based communication technologies, which clearly are going to be the future ways in which people are going to consume news, and try and create the sorts of the communicative strategies that push out more signals that are actually have some verisimilitude as against all the noise that's been perpetrated in this area. It's certainly a very intractable, difficult question, given the funding structures that affect the media.
I would just say, I think the hopeful note is that the work of Mark Jacobs and others has demonstrated renewable energy is a viable option. But it's not just that it's renewable. It is low in carbon, it's low in pollution, it's low in causing conflicts among nations, and it's hugely abundant. And it has these economic advantages, as Marx pointed out, of fixed cost of the fuel. And you know when you build it what the cost is, so you know what the cost of the energy is going to be over time. And I think it really does show that there is a huge economic opportunity here for companies to get into this business and make a change. And I think what we'll see is that as more and more work is done at the state and city and local level, eventually national governments will come around. I mean, the Europeans, Germany, other countries are really doing this right now and having spectacularly good success at it. So it's not something that is theoretical anymore. It's something that is real, and it does provide the opportunity for people to improve their lives and have truly sustainable development.
And I think that is the perfect place to end. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program. He develops computer models to study the effects of energy technologies and their emissions on climate and air pollution. William Mumma is with us. He is professor of international environmental policy and director of Fletcher's Center for International Environment and Resource Policy at Tufts University. He is a lead author of 5 intergovernmental panels on climate change reports, most recently coordinating lead author of the newest report on the role of renewable energy in addressing climate change. Ravi Rajan is professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he is the author of Modernizing Nature, Forestry in Imperial Eco-Development, 1800 to 1950. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Ishmael Karim, Carson DeZuris, who all contributed to today's show. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.
All alone in a